21. Despite Merrill's promise, he did not arrive back by tea time. It was 5:50 p.m. by the time the helicopter set him down on Holgate's Green, and he immediately telephoned Clapper's private number to bring him up to date on the autopsy. But it was Anna at the answering service that picked up, and she had a message waiting for him.
"Hello, love. The sergeant's just gone out for dinner with his lady friend, but he said if you could get back by 6 or 6:30, why don't you come and join him, and bring your wife if you like. They've gone to the Atlantic Inn. Do you know where it is, love, or do you require directions?"
Gideon did not require directions. He had passed it several times on his way to his morning pasties and coffee at the Cavorna Cafe, a pleasant-looking old hotel and pub on the main street, right at the foot of the pier. He put in a call to Julie, who was at the nightly cocktail hour in the castle dungeon. It had been canceled the night before on account of Joey's death, but Kozlov had now reinstituted it, and passed along the invitation.
"I'd love to," she exclaimed. "Aren't you dying to find out what Mike's lady friend is like?"
"What his lady friend is like? Yes, sure. I suppose so. Sure."
"Men," Julie grumbled.
As it turned out, however, Clapper's choice of lady friend surprised, and on reflection pleased both of them. It was, of all people, the bangled, gabby Madeline Goodfellow, director of the museum, and they heard her before they saw her. She and Clapper were at a table on a little whitewashed terrace in back, looking out over a picture postcard view of beached fishing boats resting all askew on the sand at low tide, and her jolly cackle of a laugh easily penetrated the buzz of conversation in the restaurant, the click of balls at the pool table, and the whirring of the slot machines.
"It's Madeline," Julie said, delighted. "How wonderful! She's just what he needs. She'll be so good for him."
"And I suspect he'll be pretty good for her, too. He's a pretty solid guy, Julie, underneath it all."
Over dinners of oxtail soup, roast beef, and Yorkshire pudding, Gideon explained what he and Merrill had come up with, keeping the more grisly autopsy details to himself in deference to Julie's and Madeline's sensibilities. Still, the conclusion was clear enough to all. Joey had been thrown from the catwalk, probably, and then bludgeoned, certainly, while he lay on the ground. Murdered. Sobered, they talked about the two killings for a while, throwing around conjectures. Obviously, Clapper had been keeping Madeline abreast, but by the time dinner was finished, and the men were into their second pints, ginger beer for Clapper, and the women into their second half pints, they livened up and conversation turned to other matters. Clapper and Madeline were to be married in the fall, and would live, not above the police station, but in a 19th-century house on Tresco that had been in Madeline's family since the 1930s and was now being restored. They would have a view over the famous old Abbey Gardens and out across the Sound toward St. Mary's, from which they would be a mere 10 minutes by boat. Gideon and Julie were enthusiastically invited to the wedding and enthusiastically accepted. They clinked glasses, Madeline's bangles jingled, and talked on and on until after 11. All in all, it was a welcome break from the events of the last few days, and Julie and Gideon were utterly relaxed as they walked back up Garrison Hill to the castle, hand in hand.
"Well, one mystery is solved anyway," Julie said.
"What would that be?"
"Remember when you showed up at the museum reception the other night, straight from the police station, and you were surprised that Madeline already knew about the bones from the beach?" Gideon nodded. "I think I can make a pretty good guess who she heard it from."
"You just might be onto something," Gideon said.
When he awakened the next morning, Gideon was sorely in need of a break. The session at the morgue had taken more out of him than he'd realized, and he wondered once again at Merrill's ability to seemingly draw strength from his gruesome work. He'd suggested to Julie that she might want to play hooky for just one morning and join him, but while she'd obviously been drawn to the idea, she felt that she owed it to Kozlov and the others to be there.
"What's the morning's topic?" Gideon had asked.
"Victor's presenting his paper on..."
She looked at her copy of the program open on the bed. A three-tiered social constructivist ecological paradigm derived from monistic subjectivist epistemology, relativist ontology, and genuinely hermeneutic methodology. God help me.
Gideon stared open-mouthed at her for a moment. Oh, well, you sure wouldn't want to miss that. Damn, sure wish I could be there.
So he was on his own, which suited him on this particular morning. After breakfast at the Carvorna Cafe, he'd been coming long enough for the waitress to ask if he wanted the usual, which he did. He decided to take advantage of the pleasant weather and see some of the island's Neolithic sites. On a whim, he'd inquired about bicycles at the Cavorna and been directed to Buckaboo Bike Hire on the Strand. Once there, he'd somewhat shamefacedly asked for the least complicated, easiest-to-operate bicycle they had. It had been a while since he'd been on one. The clerk smiled knowledgeably.
"Knowing just what you want, mate, got it right here," he said,
rolling out a one-speed, heavy-bodied Hampton Cruiser with wide tires, coaster brakes, and upright handlebars.
"Well, that do you, mate. Just like you had when you were a kid, eh?"
Indeed, it was closer to his old Schwinn than he'd believed possible.
Just what I wanted.
Armed with directions from the shop, he had cycled only a little unevenly up Telegraph Road, stopping at the Port Mellon store to pick up a picnic lunch, and then onto a dirt road until he found Bance Carn and Innocigen Graves, two well-preserved Bronze Age entrance graves, open, rectangular, half-buried chambers situated at the tops of impossibly green hills, constructed of giant granite slabs and roofed by huge capstones. With no other visitors at either place, he enjoyed pottering around for a while, but once he'd gone in and out of the chambers and marveled at the size of the building stones and wondered at how they'd gotten the massive capstones up there, there wasn't much to do. The graves were empty, of course, having long ago been excavated, and the explanatory plaques, while informative, quickly wore thin in entertainment value. A substantial mound revetted by a curb of coursed walling and a partially infilled central chamber of trapezoidal form. Still, the outing renewed him, body and spirit, and it was in a relaxed and contented frame of mind that he had his lunch of Stilton cheese, hard salami, and French bread, sitting atop the Bance Carn capstone and looking out over the moor toward the islands of Tresco and Briar. Half an hour later, having returned the bike, he stopped in at the police station, where he found Clapper and Rob eating sandwiches at Rob's desk and about to return to Starcastle to continue their poking about.
"There you are, Gideon. Sit down, just the man I wanted to see," Clapper said genially, chewing away on an archetypal English sandwich of soft white bread, crustless and thin as a dime, cucumber and egg salad, his feet up on the desk and his ankles crossed.
"Just how sure are you that those bones in the next room are really Edgar Villarreal's?"
Gideon shrugged. "Pretty sure. Everything points to him. Of course, I've been wrong before." "No, not since yesterday, when you were pretty sure it was Pete Williams. Let's not have any false modesty." "Now wait a minute, Mike, that's not fair. You know I—"
"Easy, easy," Clapper said, laughing. "Just having you a bit, no harm intended. Well, what do you make of this?"
He wiped his fingers and scrabbled unsuccessfully among the papers on the desk until Rob came up with the one he wanted.
"You read it to him, lad. It's your work, after all."
He went back to his sandwich, talking around the bites.
"And very well done, too."
Rob swallowed what he had in his mouth, dabbed his lips with a napkin, and read,
"According to Skybus records, Mr. Edgar Villarreal, who had previously booked his ticket to Bristol, did indeed fly from St. Mary's to Bristol on Flight 400 at 8 a.m. on June 7, 2003, the final day of the last consortium. It is uncertain how or exactly when he returned to the United States, but on June 8, at 3:22 p.m., he paid the parking fee for his car, a four-wheel drive Toyota SUV,
at the South Terminal long-term lot at Anchorage International Airport and exited. It was understood by an estranged sister, Maria Beasley, that he was going straight to his base camp 90 miles east of Anchorage, but she did not personally speak with him. When he failed to return home to Willow, Alaska at the beginning of August, police were notified. On August 4th, local police visiting his camp found it deserted. The vehicle was not located. Further investigation produced no.
All right, Constable, that'll do. What do you think about all this, Gideon?
I think it doesn't prove anything at all. Anyone could have taken that flight in Villarreal's name, or picked up his SUV and dumped it somewhere. Why wasn't it found at the camp? Did the bear eat that, too?
A good question, Clapper said, nodding.
But the one place where he'd had to have been who he said he was would have been the flight from England to the States, where he'd need to show a passport. And apparently there's no record of his having done that.
There isn't, Rob said. I was able to computer search the manifests of every flight from the UK to the United States from 5 p.m. on the 7th of June to noon on the 8th. The name of every person who was at the consortium shows up, except Villarreal's.
Gideon spread his hands.
Well, there you go. Somebody went to a lot of trouble to build a paper trail that proved he was alive. But the one thing he couldn't do was to get Villarreal's name on an international flight.
He gestured at the scatter of bones on the table in the cubicle across the hall.
So I'm still betting that's him right there.
Clapper finished his sandwich and stood up.
And I'm agreeing with you, he said. That's the way I see it, too. I'd like to do some more work on the bones this afternoon. Maybe I can come up with something else for you. Very good. Kyle and I are off to the castle to irritate the residents a bit more. You can have the station to yourself if you want it.
He did. He had plenty to do. There was a formal inventory and description of the bones to be prepared, and then a careful bone-by-bone analysis. The tables he'd been waiting for had arrived, with the results written up into a report that Clapper could use later on. And he needed to prepare something for Merrill as well, setting out on paper his autopsy room conclusions and a rationale to accompany them. Accepting Clapper's invitation to use his office and computer, he first wrote and printed up his findings for Merrill, then took some coffee, prepared earlier by Rob, into the cubicle where the bones were, and prepared to get to work on them. He did so with an unaccustomed sense of guilt, one that had been nagging at him for a couple of days, but which he'd managed to keep more or less at bay. The fact was, in almost every way, his handling of the skeletal analysis so far had been far short of the professionalism he demanded of his students. He'd acted like a raw grad student himself, running off in whatever new direction grabbed his interest. First, he'd rushed to find evidence of dismembering. Then he'd tried to see if the bones could have been Pete Williams's. Then he'd gotten all cut up in the fruit picker syndrome and the admittedly thrilling identification of the remains as Villarreal's. And then he'd lost interest and dropped it, the exciting part over, and what remained was a lot of measuring, counting, and describing. Understandable enough in a first-year student, but that just wasn't the way it was done. This was a science, not some magic act, in which you went around pulling one rabbit after another out of the hat, to the amazement and stupefaction of all concerned. There was a methodology, an order to be followed, and the very first, most elementary steps, laying out all the bones, not just the interesting ones in their anatomical position and inventorying them, had yet to be taken. He had made no record of the number of fragments he had, or exactly what they were, because he didn't yet know himself. After 3 days with them, right there in front of him on the table.
I'm getting careless, he thought gloomily.
No, not careless, cavalier. Rules were for lesser people, students and such, and not for him. Well, he'd put an end to that line of thinking right now. Some of the bones were still in their sacks. He got them all out onto the table, and then by way of penance, started with the ones that gave him the most trouble when it came to distinguishing between them and determining right from left. The 35 hand and foot bones. Without a text or a comparative skeleton, it wasn't easy. There was a public library just down the street, and chances were they had an atlas of anatomy he could have used. But what kind of penance would that have been? Sorting the maddeningly little bones was frustrating, but because it didn't require anything like coherent thought, it was basically a matter of comparing bone to bone, nodule to nodule, foramen to foramen. It untethered and relaxed his mind, allowing it to float off on its own. And it was while he was in this drifting, hovering state that the repugnant thought that had been niggling away at the borders of his mind broke through his defenses and entered. Julie had suggested that Joey could have been killed because he knew who had murdered Villarreal, and the killer had silenced him before he could tell anyone. And Gideon had rejected it because Joey's death had come when everyone still thought the remains were Pete Williams's. And how could anyone predict that he, Gideon, would identify them as Villarreal's the next day? But now, he realized that there was indeed someone who might have foreseen just that. A crime of passion, Clapper had called it, and most assuredly it was. But crimes of passion were hardly limited to sexual jealousies, let alone resentments over academic disputes or prima donna status. There were other possible causes, and while the specific cause he was thinking about now was as improbable as it was repugnant, it had to be looked into. If nothing else, it was the only thing he thought of so far, that might conceivably explain Joey's murder. The skeletal inventorying had waited this long. It could wait a little longer. He put down the left cuneiform bone he'd been holding in one hand, and the ballpoint he'd had in the other, and went to Rob's computer, but didn't have the password to access the internet. Instead, he locked up the station and walked a block down Garrison Lane to the little public library, the Silly's one and only, where he plunked down £5 for an hour's internet access at one of the two computers. He brought up the ProQuest search engine, typed in Selway Bitterroot and Villarreal and Grizzly or Grizzlies, clicked to sort the results by date, and waited while 75 references scrolled down the page. The last one, the oldest, was the one he wanted, and he brought it up. Canadian couple killed, partially eaten by grizzly. Bill Giles, The Associated Press. Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, Montana. In a horrific incident at Lost Horse Creek Campground on the Idaho-Montana border about 40 miles southwest of Missoula,